I think it's important to see the word mission or missio comes from the Latin mittere, to send. And that word was first used by, as far as I know, by Jesuits to describe the task of getting the rascally Protestants back in the fold. So the word mission doesn't have a very good starting point. And yet by the end of the 19th century, it was orthodoxy for Protestants. And I'll guarantee you that in Southern Baptist territory, it's orthodox. You don't believe in mission, your Christianity might be questioned. So how can a word that's unbiblical take on this kind of significance? Well, a lot of times, I think it's right that that does. The word Trinity is not found in the Bible. The word providence is not found in the Bible. But these words are trying to name things that are in the Bible. And so what is it that it's trying to name? Well, the word mission started to name the task of taking the good news to the ends of the earth and establishing a witness to the gospel in places where there was none. Okay? So mission was meaning, it was talking about that. But in the 19th century and in the 18th century, that meant going from the West to the non-West, because the non-West was where there was no witness to the gospel. And so mission was confined, I would say, to something very biblical and very important of taking the good news to places where it had never been heard. But then what began to happen is that by the mid part of the 20th century, you've got this growing, flourishing, thriving church in the other parts of the world that is now much bigger than in the rest of than in the West. And so what does mission mean anymore? What does it mean for us in Canada to send missionaries to Guatemala, when in Canada we have a lot less people going to church than people in Guatemala? What does that mean? Can mission have the idea of moving from the West to the non-West? And so there began a whole new foundation. There was a return to Scripture, because there was this assumption in the study of mission that we knew what mission was, going to other parts of the world, non-West, and what we need to do is find texts that fit that. And of course, in the Old Testament, there weren't a whole lot. There was some, like Jonah, Ruth. And Jonah doesn't fit very well, but he crossed over a sea, so that must have worked. And there's a few texts like that, but especially it doesn't work when Israel goes in and starts to slaughter the Canaanites. And so the Old Testament just doesn't seem to work very well. There's not a lot of missionary gold to be mined in the Old Testament. So what you do is you go to the New Testament, but even there's some special texts, you know, like you shall be my witnesses, which is an indicative, but it's often seen as imperative. You shall go and be my witnesses. And then we get the Great Commission, go and make disciples, and we make go into a imperative, and we ignore the Greek, and there's no go in the Greek. It's as you're going. It's a participle. As you are going, make disciples. That's the emphasis of the Great Commission. Make disciples. But we're reading through that lens, and we're looking for biblical material that'll say go to other parts of the world. And so what begins to happen is numerous people begin to say, well, let's look back at the Bible. What is mission anyway? And many of us, this includes me, start to say, well, mission is much bigger and much more important than simply sending people to other parts of the world. That is really important, and I'll come back to that. But that's not all of what mission is about in the Bible. Mission is not, first of all, the church sending some people to other parts of the world. It's first of all Jesus sending the whole people of God into the world to bear witness in life, word, and deed to the good news that the kingdom of God has arrived. Jesus ends in John 20, as the Father has sent me, I'm sending you. The Great Commission is also that same kind of commissioning. But the trouble with that is, it's this newly gathered community by Jesus. But he's now seeking the lost sheep of Israel. If you read Matthew and the Great Commission, he's seeking the lost sheep of Israel. You've got to go back into the Old Testament. And what were these lost sheep of Israel being gathered to do? Well, you've got to go back into the Old Testament and realize that from the beginning, God's people have been chosen for the sake of the world. At the very beginning, in Genesis 12, God says to Abraham, I'm going to bless you so that you will be a blessing. So mission, the idea is being a so that people, blessed so that we might be a channel of that blessing to others. How do we, and so as you read the Old Testament, how are they to be a blessing? By being a light to the nations, by being an embodiment of what God intended for human life. It's looking backward to creation, living out God's creational design, looking forward, being a preview of the coming kingdom, looking outward to saying no to the idols that cripple human life. And so mission is being a light in the midst of the nations, and that's what these people are being gathered now by Jesus. And as they are sent to make disciples, they are to be a community, but now sent to be that kind of community in every part of the world. And so I and many of us now have started seeing mission as this central theme to the whole biblical story of the way God's people are to embody good news in their lives, their words and their deeds for the sake of the world. And so for some, that has meant jettisoning cross-cultural missions. But not for, it wouldn't be for in my case. I see a model, especially in the Antiochian church, in Acts 11 and 13, where on the one hand we're told in Acts 11 that they were a community where the grace of God was upon them and people were adding people to their numbers because they saw the grace of God at work in their midst. In other words, mission nearby. But at the same time, what they did is, as it were, by the work of the Spirit, they lifted up their eyes, they saw there are many places where these communities weren't established. And so they sent Paul and Barnabas. And Paul and Barnabas went to those places. They never stayed longer than 2 years, but they established a witness to the gospel there. And then, as it were, they did what an Indian bishop used to actually literally do, take people out into the middle of the square, and he would say to them, he'd raise his hand and bless them, says, "Now you are the mission in this place." And he would move on to the next place. Now you are the mission in this place. You are the place where people are going to know the good news. And so I see missions as establishing these good news communities in every part of the world. There are still many, many people groups. There are still many, many parts of the world that need Christian communities to embody this good news. So that word mission for me now means embodying the good news. But following Leslie Newbegin, I use the word missions with an S to describe establishing a witness in places where the gospel is not known. But if I can continue, I don't know if this is a good idea to continue at this point, but if I can then make a distinction between missions and what I would call cross-cultural or inter-church aid. If I go to be a seminary professor in Kenya, I'm not doing missions. The reason is Kenya is much more Christian than Canada. And it doesn't need a new witness established there. But if I go to parts of Kenya where there's unreached people groups to establish a witness, I'm doing missions. Now you might say, that's just a distinction. That's just a fine distinction established with one little S or something. I'm saying the reason this is so important is that we are spending well over 90% of our resources, money and personnel, on inter-church aid, helping Christian churches in other parts of the world, rather than establishing churches in places where there is no witness to the gospel. And more people are calling attention to that. Urbana just called attention to that. They were, Bryant Myers calls that the scandal of the disproportionate allocation of resources. It's a scandal. And so is interchurch aid important? You bet. It's very important, but let's at least have 50% of our resources going to establishing the witness in places where it's not known. So for me, the word mission is this call of all people in the whole of their lives, words and deeds, to be good news, which involves evangelism, which involves good deeds, which involves all kinds of things. And it also involves missions, which is the horizon of our mission, taking the good news to the ends of the earth. For me, the word missional, which is a new word that's really become powerful since 1999, is simply an adjectival form of mission. It's simply saying missional church. That is, a church which takes their mission to be good news seriously. And so it's a new buzzword, means lots of things to people, but for me, it's an adjectival form of mission.
I do think a helpful summary of Mark's position, and really he articulates this so well, is the Manila Manifesto's definition of mission. The whole church taking the whole gospel to the whole world is one that I find quite helpful. And you know, what I do think we've got to revisit, and we need to revisit this in detail, are the Great Commission passages, for example, in the Gospels. So, you know, it's a long time since I worked on the Greek of Matthew 28, but I'd love to have a discussion about whether it's an imperative or not. But I think those are kind of secondary things. So, you know, it seems to me it would help just to read these texts So the Great Commission does not start in Matthew's Gospel, go and make disciples. It starts with the theology of kingdom, all authority on heaven and on earth is given to me. So this is, you know, if you're an Old Testament scholar, you're hearing Daniel 7 in the background. This is the Son of Man, Jesus' favorite self-designation. This is utterly comprehensive, okay? It resonates, you know, it's this Pauline notion that from him and through him and to him are all things. You know, it's kingdom, and really what kingdom is rooted in is a doctrine of creation. And Gordon Spykman and John Stott and others have pointed out that one of the most crippling things in contemporary evangelicalism is the eclipse of the doctrine of creation. And without a robust doctrine of creation, you won't understand kingdom. But there it is in this Great Commission text, all authority on heaven, in heaven and on earth. Incidentally, it's right there in the Lord's Prayer, if we only used the Lord's Prayer. You know, your kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. And you know, in heaven, God's rule is absolute in every sphere. And the missional prayer is that the reign of God would come where he has, we are told in Matthew 28, already got all authority. And then, you know, it's just, and then I think we would need to, so that's the background. And I mean, I think if you just start there, you've transformed the vision and you've raised all the right questions. And then it just intrigues me so much. And you know, I haven't worked on this for a long time, so there may be details that are wrong. I do understand it as an imperative, but I find what the imperative is, go and teach the nations to follow Jesus. Well, I mean, that's quite extraordinary stuff. You know, let's go teach South Africa and Nigeria. Let's teach America. I mean, what a missional challenge that would be. Let's go teach America to become a follower of Jesus. You know, on any accounting of this, it's not just go and set up little churches and build your empire, and it has absolutely nothing to do with that domain over which Christ says he has all authority. You know, so it's this, a friend of mine used to say, and we disagreed on many of these things, an Australian evangelical, very prominent in his day. And he used to say, you know, when as the church we gather around Christ, he stands with his face to his world. And if all authority on heaven and on earth, in heaven and on earth is given to him, you know, surely we have to ask the question, how does mission reflect this kingly authority over the whole of creation? You know, do we have a view of mission that does justice? So, you know, I like to think of us as ambassadors for the king, you know, except this king is, we need a new vision of the king, you know. So I use things like C.S. Lewis, that God is the hunter, the warrior, the king, the God who approaches at infinite speed. He's alive. You know, Wendell Berry, who's one of my favorite authors, says, God is the wildest thing in the creation. Now, I'm commissioned to be an ambassador for that king. And, you know, and then I'm called to go teach the nations how to follow that king. Well, you know, we could just go straight back into Psalm 1 and Psalm 2. So Psalm, which most scholars agree now is deliberately the introduction to the whole Pentateuch. Psalm 1 is all about the individual. Blessed is, in the Hebrew, the man. As Patrick Miller and others have pointed out, you get into Psalm 2, and of course the man who's blessed is the one who meditates on the instruction of the Lord. It's very individual. You must come to Christ. You must be converted. Psalm 2, which is also part of the introduction to the Psalter, the sounds are those of the nations. And what you discover in Psalm 2 is that the Torah of the Lord is as relevant to the lives of nations as it is to the one blessed individual. It's never either or. It's both and it's utterly comprehensive because of the nature of the King himself.